Welcome to the Voice Over Work podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Newton Media Group, a family of creative services. Today is Thursday, April 8th, 2021. On the podcast today, we'll take a little deeper look into a book introduced in a previous podcast with a chapter-by-chapter look at For Position Only, Truth, Lies, and Love in Advertising, Book 2. Written by Adele Royce. Narrated by Russell Newton for Hot Ghost Productions. Chapter 1. Never get accustomed to defeat. That's what I told myself every morning since that day. The worst career day of my life. I'll call it the worst career day because it certainly wasn't the worst day of my life. It's important to know the difference. That day in the office, I was blindsided. It was a complete ambush. I was working diligently on a client memo after a particularly steamy session with Hayden Town, the agency siren. That day, we had a two-hour lunch that involved a bottle of Dom and a long drive up the Pacific Coast Highway towards Malibu. Her scent still enveloped me when I returned to the office, despite numerous hand washings and teeth brushings. Someone was knocking on my door with persistence. "Come in, Cassandra," I called to my assistant, not even paying attention to the sound of the door opening and closing. I continued to tap away at my keyboard until the curious silence taunted me enough to stop typing and turn around. There stood Hayden near the door, in the same royal blue dress that I'd gathered up around her waist only an hour earlier. "What's up?" I said, getting to my feet and stepping cautiously around my desk. There was an insouciant smirk on her face as she moved closer. So close, I felt my nostrils flare at the smell of her perfume, which still lingered faintly in my mouth. I placed my hand on her waist with familiarity, thinking I was in no mood to see her so soon after our midday frolic. "You back for more?" She swatted my hand away. "You wish. You're going to want to sit down for this, Craig," she announced, shooting me a smug grin with those perfect teeth. She moved sideways around me and flounced over to the white leather couch in my office sitting area. It was opposite the fireplace, above which my most treasured Chagall painting hung. Hayden always joked. Chapter 2. Waiting for my session with Dr. Truer was always awkward. I met with her twice a week, on Mondays and Thursdays, and I never knew what to do or think when I was in the waiting room. Usually, I was still in the frenetic work mode of conference calls, emails, and constant requests for approval on client issues. Dr. Truer's whole office building smelled like old, sick people, and her office was particularly bleak. An old radio was chained with wiring to the floor so no one could steal it, as if anyone would want to. Dusty old dolls, teddy bears, board games in boxes with frayed cardboard edges sat in a wooden box to the side of the room. Back issues of Psychology Monthly beckoned from the coffee table with headlines like "Silence Your Inner Critic" and 10 Life Skills Even You Can Learn." I pulled a small bottle of hand sanitizer from the pocket of my suit jacket, feeling like I needed to douse my entire body with it. While this was not the type of place I would normally inhabit, Dr. Janice Truer was the best psychologist in the city. She'd been a close friend of Don's for years. While he never told me, I suspected Don had referred numerous mob clients while in San Francisco. I'd heard from Don that she had relocated and set up shop in L.A. I figured she'd be frank, wise, and helpful. I never told anyone I was in therapy, especially not Don. He would see it as a sign of weakness. I heard Dr. Truer's heavy, uneven footsteps draw closer and her inner door open and shut. She opened the door to the waiting room and stepped out. She always appeared to have stuck her finger in a light socket, with that frizzy blonde mop of hair sticking out in every direction. Her pale, freckled face was slightly shiny and her eyes bland. Chapter 3. Ben Whitman was in my office, yammering on about some ass he was chasing, like he always did. I often wondered why I ever partnered with him in the first place. He was so shallow and uninteresting, with his constant pursuit of office women, his ability to bring projects over the finish line, his lack of passion and energy. We were in the same fraternity at Stanford, and I had a soft spot for him when we started the agency. That's why I took him in as a full partner. Still, he never added value, never had any good ideas. He was basically window dressing. A good-looking mannequin in an expensive suit. He needed to go. I stared at him silently, watching his mouth move, but not listening to what was coming out of it. Cassandra called, interrupting his tedious soliloquy, and I answered on speakerphone. "I have Warren Mitchell for you," she said loudly. Ben's eyes immediately darted up to meet mine. He wore a surprised expression. "It's about a board we're serving on," I explained without skipping a beat. "Will you please excuse me?" Ben left without a question as I picked up the phone and told Cassandra to put him through. "Warren," I said into the receiver. I was hoping he had good news for me. But his voice was measured. "I wanted to let you know I spoke to Jane and Jeffrey about your initial proposal," he started. "And?" I asked, feeling my neck tense up slightly. "Jane had nothing but positive things to say about weighting our business more heavily on the digital side, on consumer-centric analysis. Her only concern is partnering with you." I felt a stab in my gut at Jane's negative assessment of me. "What about Jeffrey?" "Well, Jeffrey knew you in a past life." Chapter 4. Pearl was at her desk when I entered the lobby of Mitchell, Vance, and Mercer.
"Mr. Keller, my, we're seeing an awful lot of you this week," she greeted me, smiling in a flirtatious way.
I gave her one of my most flirtatious smiles right back.
"And who are you here to see today?" she asked, eyes scanning me with approval.
"Jane Mercer," I answered, and felt a little twinge in my stomach. I had selected a suit Jane would love. It was jet black and paired with a pale blue shirt with thin black pinstripes. I wore subtle, knotted platinum cufflinks and went tie-less, thinking it might disarm her a bit, make her feel like our conversation was more casual. Jane responded better when I wore black, something I sensed in the early days of our relationship. My bullet points were ready, but an unrelenting nervousness crept over me. "What if she throws me a curveball?" I thought. I rarely felt this type of anxiety prior to a meeting with anyone.
"Just stick to the main points and you'll be fine," I encouraged myself. "Of course. Let me call her. Please have a seat."
I sat and anxiously flipped through Advertising Age, which was filled with the usual gossip about competing agencies, the latest PR wins, and stories about who lost ground on Facebook and YouTube. After about 10 minutes, I checked my watch and then glanced up at Pearl. She was typing away on her computer, oblivious that I had waited longer than the standard 5 minutes. I pictured Jane, sitting in her office, pleased with herself that she was able to make me wait. I shifted in my chair, and just as I was about to express my impatience, Pearl's phone rang.
"Of course, I'll show him to your office right away," she said.
When she hung up, she glanced at me and smiled. Chapter 5. I strolled into the Mitchell, Vance, and Mercer lobby Saturday and passed Pearl's empty desk. It was almost 1:30 and Warren's door was closed. I heard muffled voices coming from inside the office, and I knocked on the door. It was Jeffrey who answered.
"Craig?" He greeted me stiffly, like he was not at all pleased to see me again.
"Come in." Jeffrey and I had a congenial relationship most of the time, at least before he found out what had gone on between Jane and me. He always wore a smart-assed expression with his hipster horn-rimmed glasses and spiky hair. Today, he was wearing a nerdy sweater vest over a long-sleeve button-down shirt, giving him a collegiate look. Warren and Jane were seated at his round conference table leaning into each other, obviously engaged in prequel dialogue. Jane's back was to me. Warren looked up as I approached.
"Craig,"
Warren called, waving me over to the conference table. It was the first time he called me Craig since the last time I worked for him years before. I never said anything to him directly, but I hated that he called me Keller. I preferred Craig, or Mr. Keller. Keller, on its own, reminded me of some football star getting a beatdown by his bullying coach.
I approached the table with Jeffrey and waited to see where he sat. He took the seat to Jane's immediate left. Warren was on her right. Great, I thought. The two fathers are flanking their little girl, shielding her from predatory me. I walked around the table and took the seat directly across from Jane, Warren to my left, and Jeffrey to my right. My eyes met Jane's briefly, and I felt my stomach flip-flop, the familiar rush vibrating through me again. Her expression was placid, and she said nothing. Today, she was wearing a white pantsuit. Chapter 6. Warren did exactly what I thought he would do with my draw. He accepted my original proposal, which was a big compliment. It showed he genuinely believed I would make more money on prospects than anyone else there could. We agreed that, first, I would cherry-pick the employees I wanted to bring with me to the new agency, speak to them, and urge them to get on board. Next, we'd put together a joint press release announcing both the dissolution of Keller Whitman Group and the formation of Mitchell Keller Vance and Mercer. I decided to speak to Bobby first. She was, after all, one of Keller Whitman Group's day one employees. I had persuaded her to leave a huge gig at Ogilvy in New York, and she became my trusted advisor on everything media-related. She'd also become a loyal friend, someone I could rely on to always tell me the truth. I used Bobby as the office barometer. She kept tabs on how employees and management worked together, kept me aware of dissenters and defectors, and warned me of upcoming client disasters. I heavily depended on Bobby for just about everything. The only time Bobby failed me was with Hayden. Bobby was even more surprised than I was. It was a debacle that left us scratching our heads. How did she manage to pull one over on both of us? I thought I knew why. I never considered Hayden a threat, because I was still sleeping with her. And although Bobby never let on, she knew I was sleeping with her. Throughout the 2 years Hayden worked at my agency, I was preoccupied with buying out Warren's agency. I still kicked myself for not being more suspicious of Hayden's motives. And while she was available most of the time, she wasn't even that good in bed. She was beautiful, but strangely sexless and uninteresting. One of the women I... Chapter 7. According to Dr. Janice Truer, part of the process of letting go was moving forward, and after some time into my new venture with Mitchell Keller Vance and Mercer, I was feeling like things were sailing along at a swift pace. News of the freshly merged agency had traveled quickly throughout the city, and we heard, through several sources, that Town Inc. was feeling vulnerable. I was sure Hayden would focus on retaining the clients she stole from me, as well as the acquisition of new business that we would be going after. It was going to be a bloody battle, and I was ready. Ready to do whatever it took to slay her. There were a few hiccups in moving new teams into Warren's building, a few disagreements and hurt feelings through the shifting offices and dedicating space, but overall, I considered it a smooth transition. When I originally signed the contract with Warren, he advised there was an option for an additional 20,000 square feet of space within his building, so we were able to house an entire digital marketing and analytics team. Slowly, I began to feel a camaraderie among partners, too. Jane was the exception. No matter what I said or did, she just wouldn't warm up to me. The first few weeks were the most difficult. I had a tough time seeing her as an equal partner, just as Warren had predicted. I often had to stop myself from interrupting her when she was saying something I disagreed with, dismissing her ideas as silly or naive. The other part was purely sexual. I was keenly aware of her clothing and hairstyles, the way she looked and smelled, so squeaky clean. I wanted to mess her up, to tear her clothes and pull her hair, to bite into her flesh without mercy. Her blatant show of distaste both attracted and infuriated me, and she kept her distance as though I were an ugly... Chapter 8. Bobby was in my office bright and early, jabbering on about office politics. I sipped my cappuccino and listened with interest. This is how I started most days, with Bobby giving me the lowdown in her amusing New York Jewish way. She must have been behind on her Nicorette gum count for the morning, because she seemed a little more hyper than usual. You know, "This place could use a bit of humor," she declared, pulling a piece of gum from the pocket of her long, full skirt and popping it into her mouth. "How so?" I asked, with a smile in my eyes. It was tough for me not to burst out laughing at Bobby's way, even if she hadn't yet said anything funny. Bobby was funny most of the time, without knowing it. "That Veronica, she's a real turd in the punch bowl, you know?" Bobby was now chomping her nicorette, the occasional spitball flying out of her mouth. Thankfully, she was far enough away so that the saliva rockets were not hitting my desk. "She called me into her office the other day to tell me I'm no longer to refer to my male employees as boy chick." I raised my eyebrows. "Really? Did one of your employees complain?" "Of course not," she claimed. "Veronica overheard me. You know, she slinks around here like a double agent, so you'd better keep your schmuck in your pants, if you know what I mean." I instinctively straightened up in my chair, crossed my legs, but said nothing. "I'd better not call you the Shayna Poonam anymore, either. She'll probably have me written up for being insubordinate to the partners." Bobby always called me Shayna Poonam, or simply Shayna, which was Yiddish for handsome or something. It wasn't meant to flatter me. Bobby flattered no one. She simply called things as they were. "Tell you what, Bobby, you can call me whatever you want," I said, now grinning at her. "I'll take care of Veronica." Chapter 9. Jane wasted no time relating my misdeeds with Lisa Bossio to Warren, who promptly called me into his office. When I entered, his mouth had tightened into a straight line, and he seemed to be clenching his teeth as he paced the floor. "Keller, you want to tell me what went on at lunch today?" he demanded, inspecting me with his steely gray eyes. He had this way of blinking numerous times when he was angered by something. "I'm not really sure," I answered. "I would never volunteer information until I knew what I was being accused of." "You mean to tell me you didn't run into Hayden Town at a restaurant this afternoon? And what the hell are you doing having lunch off campus with Jane anyway? Didn't I tell you to stay away from her?" "Which issue would you like me to address first, Warren?" My neck stiffened. "Did Hayden Town publicly accuse you today of sleeping with Lisa Bossio to influence her boss and keep us on at Wild Paint?" He'd stopped pacing now and was standing straight in front of me, eyes piercing mine. He was so close, a hint of his sharp, serious cologne drifted into my nostrils. I felt like I was in court, under oath, about to perjure myself. "Yes, she accused me of it, but she says a lot of things that have no basis in reality." "Whose reality are we talking about, Craig? Yours or everyone else's? One minute, we're scrambling to get new concepts ready to save a major client, and the next, you're sailing in with news that the account is no longer up for review. How else in this industry does that happen?" He had momentarily gone back to pacing the floor of his office, but had stopped in front of me and was again glaring, expecting an answer. I sighed deeply. Chapter 10. Saturday came around after a long week, and it was a weekend without Axel and Annabelle. On these weekends, I usually got up, drank coffee, and took a long walk on the beach. Then I'd take an extra hot shower and head into the office. Saturdays were a perfect day to work because they gave me a chance to catch up, to strategically think through challenges without interruption. I often went in on Sundays, too. The office had always been a refuge for me, especially when I was married. It was my escape, free time to do what I wanted. I loved weekends like this. I arrived at the office around 3:30 and entered the deserted office lobby. This was going to be a great day. No distractions. I thought about my partners, all ensconced in their domestic lives, and suddenly Jane came to mind. She must be working through her demons with the violinist. I pictured her at home on the couch, weeping, while her husband gave pitiful excuses about being date-raped by Hayden. I had to admit, as lame an excuse as it was for committing adultery with a beautiful woman, it wasn't entirely outside the realm of possibility. Hayden obviously went after him, specifically to get to Jane, but why? Hayden only slept with men when there was something in it for her. In this case, I couldn't figure out her motive, unless it was simply out of rotten spite. She'd always been jealous of Jane, jealous of my feelings for her. There had to be some way I could make Hayden pay for this outrageous blow to Jane's marriage, but I hadn't yet come up with a plan. My initial threat had already been disregarded. If I came back with anything, it would have to be serious. Serious enough to bludgeon her into subservience for good. Chapter 11. The sun's rays drenched my bedroom with a tortuous palette of early morning hues, mauve, tangerine, indigo, and violet. It reminded me of one of my treasured Chagall paintings, Maison, the poet. It was a rare portrait of the artist's poet friend seated at a table with a book of poems resting in his lap. The only objects contrasting with the meditative mood of the painting were the multicolored book and the bottle to the far right. I smiled. I originally had the skylight installed directly above my bed so I could see the stars on clear nights. Mornings at the beach were usually overcast and foggy, thick with the marine layer until noon. But not today. There was a rare glimpse of a cloudless sunrise, and I couldn't help but feel calm and happy for the first time in years. I didn't want to get up. Then I rolled over and saw her. It was Jane, sleeping beside me, naked. What the? I couldn't have. I thought back to everything I was doing and feeling, seemingly dreaming I was with her. But was it real? She was naked next to me. What had I done? I broke into a cold sweat and scrambled to get out of bed, feeling for leftover dampness on the sheets, evidence, but I could find none. I was naked and my pajamas were strewn across the floor on one side of the bed. I grabbed the bottoms and pulled them on quickly, afraid she'd wake up and accuse me of rape. As I shakily tied the drawstring on the pajama bottoms, the murky memory of Jane crawling into bed with me in the middle of the night returned. The scotch had made me so woozy, I couldn't remember exactly what happened. I gazed upon Jane lying on her side with her back. 12. I arrived at Dr. Truer's office early Thursday evening. I normally got there right on time so I wouldn't have to inhale the musty waiting room scent. Today, I sat there nervously scanning my phone, eyes occasionally darting at the old radio wired to the floor. For once, I urgently needed Dr. Truer's help. I'd spent the entire week obsessing over and avoiding Jane. Even when we saw each other in meetings, I sat far away from her and tried not to make eye contact. Then at night, I'd go home and work out for hours, attempting to get her out of my head. After my shower, I'd go into my closet to get a clean pair of pajamas, the olive-green silk robe hanging in front of me. I'd leave it hanging there, taunting me. I had a game in which I would try to put on pajamas and make it out of the closet before I touched the robe. Then I'd quickly return and pull it off the hanger, cover my face with it, and try to pick up the scent she left behind. The smell of her glorious skin was growing fainter and fainter with each passing day. After every robe episode, I'd settle into bed and sip my scotch. I'd think about her until I could get to sleep. I didn't even masturbate because it seemed absurd when I just had the real thing. I could only conjure images from the previous weekend and savor them, praying they wouldn't fade unceremoniously from my mind. Dr. Truer ushered me into her office, and I'd barely sat down before announcing, "I need to talk to you about something that happened last weekend, about someone." Dr. Truer's eyes lit up slightly. It was the first time I'd ever spoken without prodding and prying. I was never comfortable talking in therapy, but today was... Chapter 13. The drive toward Long Beach on the 405 was jam-packed with rush hour traffic. It was also Thanksgiving week, so the freeway was a sea of cars scrambling to get to the airport. Bobby was busy yapping in the passenger seat, loudly chomping and popping her Nicorette gum. A long time ago, she tried to light up a cigarette in my car, but I had rebuked her so harshly she never tried it again. What a schlep, Bobby remarked, peeping out the window when traffic came to a halt. How come her grandparents live so far south? I questioned. Jane grew up there, in that exact house. Maybe she'll want a grandmother closer to her now, Bobby mused. Have you talked to her? I asked. I mean, since her grandfather passed away? Not really, she answered. I just got texts here and there with directions and times. Was it her paternal or maternal grandfather? I asked, now curious as to who raised the amazing Jane. Paternal, Bobby responded. So they're Mercers. I've never been to a Shiva home, I commented, abruptly changing lanes to get around a slow-moving truck. Bobby's whole body jerked to the right when I made this move, because she refused to wear her seatbelt. She always connected it before she got in, so the alarm wouldn't beep incessantly. Oh, it's a lot of talking and eating, Bobby explained, readjusting her seat. You'll be fine. When we arrived, I couldn't help but be struck by the age of the neighborhood and the house itself. It was in suburban Long Beach, which was quite different from Malibu. I looked around at the old, decrepit mulberry trees planted near the sidewalk, which was heavily cracked, probably from earthquakes of yore. I pictured Jane as a young girl, walking home from school without a hint of knowledge of the spectacular woman. Chapter 14. Thanksgiving was a day away, and I sat in my office trying to concentrate on work. I had passed Jane's door several times, knowing it would remain closed and locked, her office dark inside until she returned. I resisted the urge to call and see how she was. This holiday season would be the most difficult for her, simultaneously grieving a loved one and going through a marital crisis. Right before we closed the office for the holidays, I got a surprise visit from Marissa Silva, Jane's best friend. Pearl buzzed my office and announced she was in the lobby waiting for me. There was an excited quality to Pearl's voice. I wasted no time strolling out to meet her, wondering why on earth she would want to see me. We had a history. I didn't suspect it would be pleasant. Marissa? I greeted her without warmth. She stood and approached me, wearing a snug olive pantsuit with a creme silk blouse underneath. Marissa was a beautiful woman, but not at all my type. She was just one of those women who grated on my nerves. Too aggressive for my taste. Craig Keller, she began, voice clipped. Thanks for seeing me. I would have called, but I happened to be in the neighborhood and decided to stop by instead. Would you like to step into my office? I couldn't help but notice people pausing in the lobby, gawking at Marissa. The agency had its share of high-profile, famous clients, but Marissa had her own talk show and was an international celebrity. She was the Latina version of Oprah. The employees likely thought her a prospective client. That'd be great, she responded, again, in the staccato tone, as she followed me down the hall. Once we were in my office, I closed the door and gestured for her to sit down in one of the chairs. Chapter 15. Bobby was in my office bright and early Monday, snapping her Nicorette and gulping coffee. She'd never been married, and I could see why. What man would put up with the incessant smoking and consumption of nicotine gum? She always reeked of coffee and stale cigarettes. I tried not to get too close most of the time, even though I loved her dearly. This morning's rant had to do with Veronica's new policy that shorted everyone's vacation by 3 days. They were bullshit holidays, like Flag Day and President's Weekend, but Bobby was not happy. I work my tuckus off, she bleated, intermittently gulping at the coffee and shoving the gum into her mouth, the sticky masses pomping as she chomped. I don't even take sick days, but I like my holidays off. All the other agencies get those days off. I just sat sipping my cappuccino and waiting for Bobby's rant to end. Then take the days off. You know I don't care, I finally interjected. But it's not you who keeps track of it, she argued. Veronica's the attendant Nazi. She'll charge me vacation time. I yawned and browsed my computer screen. How was your Thanksgiving? She asked, as though she suddenly realized there was another person in the room. It was great. The parents were in, I'm glad it's over. Now, I just have to get through Christmas. Bobby knew I couldn't stand the holiday season. How was yours?
Oh, you know, I don't get into the whole Thanksgiving thing, she said with a wave of her hand. I went to a friend's house.
It struck me that Bobby was lonely. Her parents were gone, and she had no husband and no children. I knew she had a niece who lived in New York. I should have been... After 16.
Annabelle? Honey?
I said, peering down at my daughter, who was attached to a ventilator.
Annabelle, it's Daddy.
Her eyes blinked open, and she tried to say something.
Shh! Don't talk, sweetheart,
I told her.
Save your breath. You're going to be okay. I'll stay here with you until you feel better.
She just blinked again, and her honey-colored eyes widened. It broke my heart to see her in such distress. I leaned over and kissed her forehead, which felt hot against my lips.
Annabelle, I love you so much, I whispered. You have no idea. You're going to be okay. You have to be.
She looked so small and pitiful in the hospital bed. I would have given anything to be the sick one and fighting to breathe. I just wanted to take her pain away, to suffer for her. Alessandra was sitting in the chair near the hospital bed, arms folded, undoubtedly still sulking at the revelation that I loved Jane. I never should have told her, but I had bottled it up for so long I couldn't help it. I hated myself for being so weak and not just telling Jane earlier. I fantasized about Jane being Annabelle's mother and how she would be acting right now. I doubted she'd be sulking in a chair. Jane was so down-to-earth and real. I secretly wished she were by my side right now, sharing with me the pain of seeing my daughter struggle. I knew she would be loving and wonderful. Once Annabelle had fallen asleep, I stole away to the waiting room and dialed Jane's cell. She didn't pick up. Upon getting her voicemail, I wasn't sure what to say. Jane, it's me. I'm sorry about this morning. Chapter 17. The morning's suit selection process was moving slower than usual, for today was to be a special day. I wondered, what does one wear for his final act? I thumbed through the blues, passing them by altogether. I went through shades of green, gray, black, a variety of checks, houndstooth, plaids, pinstripes, and then I found it. It was one of the charcoal hues, wool, with a subtle pinstripe on the pants and jacket. I selected a lighter gray, snug cardigan with an accentuated black border trim to wear under the jacket and over one of my hundreds of white button-down shirts. A gray tie with amethyst and black dots finished the smart look. I'd wear black lace-up Oxfords and a black belt. I selected a timepiece for my wall safe, an IWC Schaffhausen Da Vinci edition with an alligator watch band. Once I'd fastened the strap, I took one more long look in the mirror. I drove the Bentley to work with the top down, counting the number of women who craned their necks to watch me drive. 5, 6, 7. Oh, there are two together. That makes 9 in less than 2 miles. I imagined their discussion.
Did you see that gorgeous man? Did you see his car? I'll bet he's loaded. I'll bet he has the most beautiful women in the world. He must be the happiest man on earth.
I smirked at the thought. 10, 11, 12, 13. I was rounding the corner into the parking lot of the agency that bore my name on the side of the building. I thought, 13's a new record. I must look good. I glanced at my reflection in the rearview mirror. I am one good-looking son of a bitch, as Don always said. I strolled into the lobby and passed Jane Mercer's closed office door. Chapter 18. I drove like a madman toward downtown, as though laws no longer applied to me. I was an outlaw, waiting to be captured, a prisoner who escaped, recklessly spiraling into a frenzy without walls, boundaries, rules. I drove the Bentley with the top down and the windows open, my hair raging in the gust of the convertible wind speed. I ran stoplights, swerved past cars, and pressed my foot down on the gas pedal further and further, flying toward... where, really? I had no idea where I was going, but knew I'd end up somewhere. I did. It was the corner of Central and Fifth Street in Skid Row, close to where I originally found Alonzo. I peeled onto the side of the street corner and jerked the car into park. The area was well lit. I didn't bother putting up the top, closing the windows, or locking the doors. I got out and walked northwest on Fifth past Town Avenue to the real dregs, the insane apocalypse that was San Pedro Street. I wandered through the abyss in my custom-made Italian suit, marching to an unheeded cadence, lulled into the sad depths of humanity, where real people suffered, sleeping on the streets and eating out of garbage cans. San Pedro was where the nucleus of filth and homelessness stretched out for blocks. Mismatched and discolored tents lined the sidewalks, along with dilapidated umbrellas the colors of faded rainbows. Trash bags, stuffed with some poor soul's earthly possessions, sat off to the side. Broken, abandoned bicycle parts, filthy blankets, and useless possessions discarded from someone's basement appeared from every angle. I spotted a stray pit bull roaming the neighborhood, sniffing at a painter bucket covered with plywood, the stench revealing it was a makeshift commode. A huge Chrysler pulled. Chapter 19. A splash of color painted the sky at dusk as I lay on my back in the sand, examining the unpredictable cloud formations and colors, the sun slowly disappearing along the horizon, streaming shades of rose, azure, violet, blush, tangerine, and gold, reflecting their shimmering spectrum on the ocean water at twilight. I was reminded of a Claude Monet painting. DJ was lying on his stomach next to me, doodling something in the sand with a discarded popsicle stick. "You know what I miss the most?" he asked me. "What's that, DJ?" "I miss our big family dinners, you know, at the holidays." I nodded and leaned over to see what DJ was doodling. It was a big heart with a cross woven through it, something we would have drawn as young children to delineate which girl we had a crush on at that time. "Those dinners were never the same without you," I responded. "They could never be." "I hope you still have those dinners." "We mostly have smaller versions of them now, just Don and Julia and me in L.A. When I was married, we used to go to San Francisco and see all the aunts, uncles, cousins. But it's tough to get my children there." "Oh, that's right. You never met my children. I have two, Axel and Annabelle. You'd love them. Annabelle looks just like you." "Sorry I never met them," DJ answered, tossing the popsicle stick aside, turning over on his back and gazing at what was left of the sunset. It was becoming darker by the minute as the sun's fiery rays descended behind the ocean, preparing to say goodnight. "I'm sorry too, DJ. Sorry for so many things," I said, feeling tears in my eyes. "I'm sorry." Chapter 20. Dr. Gonzalez released me to go home the week before Christmas. My eye had healed to the point where I could see, but there was a deep scar above it. The doctor told me that time would eliminate the scar without the help of plastic surgery, and he gave me a salve to put on it several times a day. The wound to the back of my head was almost completely healed. My hair was growing back. While I was in the hospital, Meseret Mary visited me every day, and we became fast friends. She was 27 and had been homeless since she was 10. I couldn't imagine growing up on the street, but she had somehow triumphed. Over incalculable odds, she had survived. She calmed me with her stories of living on Skid Row and the freedom of being homeless. I often asked her what her aspirations were, but she didn't seem to have any. She was comfortable in the discomfort she had known her whole life. I was astonished. I grew fond of her. So fond, I promised to return to the mission to see her, and I meant it. It was a bittersweet parting when I finally discharged from the hospital to return to my old life, or some version of it. I had no idea what I was in for. Alessandra brought Axel and Annabelle to see me at the urgent request of Don and Julia. Don had long since flown back to San Francisco to handle his court appearances, but he left Julia behind at my house to get things in order, assist with acquiring a replacement for my destroyed vehicle, and a new phone, deal with insurance adjusters, etc. The police questioned me, but I feigned complete amnesia about what happened. I told them my only memory was of stopping in the area because of car trouble, but that I recalled nothing after. So there were no charges to file. All I wanted. Chapter 21. Christmas Eve was upon us, and the house was buzzing with activity. Julia had Christmas music playing nonstop and spent most of her time in the kitchen with the kids, engaging them in cookie baking and other holiday traditions. I reflected on the past few weeks of my life and felt like I'd taken a long, arduous journey, but had not yet returned. My mind was consumed with thoughts of Jane. I had several dreams about her since that night at Millie's. The dreams were always of us walking on the beach, like we did that rainy day. I no longer kidded myself that she would ever be with me now. My thoughts were more about what I had learned from being in love with her, from finding out what love really felt like. It was everything I said in the OurVows.com presentation. It struck me that the only way I was able to give that presentation in the first place was from knowing real love with Jane. She had educated me. I also understood now what it was like to be hurt by a woman, hideously and mercilessly heartbroken, with no way to leap over it and put it behind me. I would have to wallow in the pain, wade deep into a dark and murky well, and wait it out, day after day, taking a small step up, one at a time, clutching at the slippery stones with all my might, desperately searching for a light at the top to find my way out. It abruptly hit me what all those sentimental love ballads were about. The grief that inspired the lyrics of so many songs I'd heard before, but which, pre-Jane, meant nothing, and resonated in no way, unless they somehow directly reminded me of DJ. This had all changed after being with Jane. Chapter 22. New Year's Eve crept over me with the lonely revelation that I had no real friends except Bobby, Alonzo, and Mesrit. I'd spent most of my unoccupied time with my previous lineup, or some version of it, a group of women I had no interest in contacting now, and I had no interest in recruiting new ones. They just all seemed so unremarkable in comparison to Jane. I compared every woman with her, even women I saw on the street, women who would have been attractive to me before Jane. I spent the evening on the couch reading Kurt Vonnegut's short stories from A Man Without a Country. I knew the stories had a lot of material that sketched out the differences between men and women. I stretched out on the large sectional and read story after story until I became sleepy and retired to bed. I skipped the scotch and shut off the lights. For the first time in years, I retired before midnight. The first week of January, I received a call from Warren. After some pleasantries, he got to the real reason he was calling, to ask when I was planning to come back to the agency. "Keller, we've missed you," he stressed in a voice that told me he meant it. "I know you said you violated your contract, but now I don't know what to believe." "You think I made that up?" I asked, wondering what Warren was getting at. "Veronica interviewed every female employee at our agency, and they all denied involvement with you. In fact, they were mostly complimentary, and I'm sure this won't surprise you, find you the most charming and attractive partner at the agency." Of course they did, I thought. I had only expressed interest in Jane, so the rest of the women at the agency would naturally think me an elusive gentleman. Laughable. Veronica. Chapter 23. "What do you think, boss?" Alonzo asked as he spread the last of the ad layouts before me. "We don't have much time on this one." I sighed. It was just like Alonzo to wait until the last minute on something this important. The truth was that the concepts were great. I could tell he was inspired. Warren and Jeffrey suddenly appeared in the doorway of the war room. "Craig, do you have a minute?" Warren asked. I glanced at Alonzo, who was looking for a quick approval on something, anything, so he could in turn get client approval. I turned to Warren and Jeffrey. Of course, but I'd love your opinion on these concepts. Warren sauntered over to the table with Jeffrey in tow, and they both looked over my shoulder. Ah, Kenton Fox again. Which one do you like? Warren asked me. I shrugged. I think they're all effective, but this one seems to stay with me, I responded, tapping my fingers on one of Alonzo's creations. Then let's go with that, Warren responded. Jeffrey immediately nodded in agreement. Do we need to check with our other partner first? Warren asked. Normally I'd say that'd be a wise move, but since she's off today, it's Friday after 5, and we're backed up to a drop-dead deadline. I shook my head and shot a look at Alonzo. You have your approval. Thanks, boss, he chirped, before scooping the pages from the table, long black hair undulating as he flew out the door to make deadline. Warren and I exchanged wry smiles as we exited the war room, walking down the hallway side by side. Have a good weekend, Jeffrey called to us as he headed in the opposite direction toward his office. What was it you wanted to see me about? I asked, glancing at Warren as we walked. I found out today Town Link is... This has been For Position Only, Truth, Lies, and Love in Advertising, Book 2, written by Adele Royce, narrated by Russell Newton for Hot Ghost Productions. Copyright 2021 by Madweek Marketing, LLC. Production copyright by Madweek Marketing, LLC. Please be sure to visit Amazon.com or Audible.com for more information on this book and the author. With an eclectic collection of water cooler knowledge, inspirational stories, and motivational thoughts from some of the newest audiobooks on the market, this has been the Voice Overwork Podcast, brought to you by Newton Media Group, a family of creative services.